Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be visiting with St. Louis Public Radio's Maria Altman on assignment in Ireland. But first, we're going to focus on the threat of terrorism in the homeland. We got a disturbing taste of it a few days ago in New York and New Jersey. Then a suspicious package outside City Hall here brought a bomb and arson squad response. It turned out to be harmless. But it also reinforced the Department of Homeland Security's motto, "If you see something, say something" campaign. With us in studio to talk about all of this is Captain Gregory Favor. He's the Homeland Security Officer with the St. Louis Fire Department, also a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Dr. Remy Cross is the Department Chair for Webster University's Criminal Justice and Sociology Program. He also teaches a terrorism class. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Don.
Yeah, thank you.
Should we be doing this program? Should we be alarming people at this juncture, given what's happened in New York and, more importantly, what's happened here? Remy?
So this sort of program, I think, may fall under what sometimes gets characterized as security theater, in that in its effects and its ability to actually identify and reduce threats, it's probably minimal. But it is a visible way of reassuring people that there's something that's being done. And so I'd sort of characterize these sorts of programs as benign to potentially problematic, but I don't know that they are particularly effective in doing what it says on the box. There is research that New York Times had done investigation on New York City's program, one of the original See Something, Say Something, and they found that the actual rates of generating credible reports that led to real intelligence were quite low, often less than 10%, and that the number of tips that led to actual arrests was less than 0.1%, and none of those, over the period of time the New York Times examined it, were actually related to terrorism. So it ties up some resources, but it does provide people sort of a way of looking at these things, and there's some other things we can get into with regard to what it's actually asking people to do with regards to how people identify threats. But I want to give Greg a chance.
Go ahead, Greg. You respond to that as well, please.
So I agree with the professor that it is certainly part of the security apparatus and some may say the security theater that we've established. But most people feel like there is both a very moral imperative and a very practical vested interest in our collective security, and people need to have some sort of outlined way to reach out to somebody when things don't appear quite as they seem. So the see something, say something, we often, those of us kind of in the security field, often point to the 2010 Times Square bombing, mm-hmm. or attempted bombing that was actually somebody who was a complete civilian, had no law enforcement, no security training, actually made the initial contact, said something isn't right here, and started the chain of events that ultimately led to a car bomb being disassembled. And it was a sizable bomb. It no doubt would have caused some substantial damage. So in the same way, I view see something, say something, and I think most of my colleagues view this, in the same way that you are not statistically likely to get mugged in a dark alleyway, we still encourage people to park under streetlights. In the way that we encourage people to walk campuses with a partner, it is part of a collective agreement that we have to all take some vested interest in maintaining our collective security.
Well clearly there is some concern. I mean, who knew that the St. Louis Fire Department had a Homeland Security Officer, if
yes.
you will. I mean,
yes.
I had no idea that that was the case. You're a member of a terrorism task force. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, people are edgy.
Yes, and I think the other piece is that over the last 15 years, we have seen silos that were definitely set up pre-9/11 start to be broken down. So, in the event like the City Hall incident that we had earlier this week, that's largely a law enforcement response. That being said, there's a whole chain of notification that happens down the line, and depending on what the severity of the threat is, the fire department can play a very active role in that mitigation pattern. Without having people who are vertically integrated throughout, whether it's public health, whether it's emergency management, whether it's academia, and certainly fire department and law enforcement working together, we have found not only here in St. Louis but elsewhere in the country that this is an excellent model in kind of cross collaboration and sharing information prior to something happening.
Remy, was there an overreaction to that that suitcase in front of City Hall?
No, I don't think so. And this is part of the post 9/11 world that we live in. Is you can't treat potential threats as non sort of problematic. You can't just brush it off. And that is both a strength of some of the responses, but also a potential weakness that people that may want to do harm are aware of and can take advantage of, because these responses have to treat any given threat as potentially legitimate. But that means that if I have bad intentions, I can drain resources in what tends to get called sort of a form of asymmetric warfare by generating false threats, and each and every one of those has to be responded to. So you're sort of put in a difficult position when you're in the position that Greg is, where you can't take these things non-seriously. Each and every one has to be treated as though it is a legitimate threat, even though the vast majority of them may not be, and it also is a potential weakness that can be exploited.
Let me get your take on this. The robot that was brought in this particular situation fell over. A lot of people laughed at that, and you know, but I think you have to ask the question. People then began to take this kind of thing lightly. Our equipment doesn't work, and that sort of thing. I mean, that I think was fairly damaging, the reaction to that.
And I think that's the wrong reaction. If you ask anybody that's involved in handling and responding to these situations, they would much rather have a robot than an actual human being put into these dangerous situations. So maybe the technology isn't quite there yet, but we want to continue to push it along because it reduces the actual threat to first responders, to the people who may be called upon to do a very dangerous job in these situations. And it's easy to make light of it, but sometimes I think that comes out of sort of relief that this was a sort of an incident that wasn't something that was dangerous.
Greg Faber, do you have a take on that?
So the fire department's fire investigation unit works very closely with the regional bomb and arson unit, and we're often kind of partnered up on a lot of these things. And I know that they have great gear and they train often, and these are guys who they're not making traffic stops on the highway. Like, what they do is bomb and arson. That's mm-hmm. that's their sole get. And whether it was stuff immediately after 9/11 with anthrax and some different hazardous materials, that suspected hazardous materials that were showing up, to something more immediate like the stuff that we've seen just even in the last 18 months, bomb responses. I would love to tell you that everything goes perfect on every emergency scene, but I've been doing this almost 15 years, and it is dynamic. And it's unfortunate when the robot falls over, but I also know that is not par for the course. And there are remediation that they can do to sure. affect and correct that.
Still better than an officer being blown up, in fact.
Yes, absolutely. And as we saw in New Jersey, when the final bombs that were found in New Jersey before they actually caught the suspect, they sent a robot up, and as he was rendering safe the device, the way that the device was rigged, it actually exploded.
Sure.
I would much rather replace the arm of that robot than be burying an officer.
Right. I was walking in the park this morning, and in the park there was a big box off to the side on the lawn. It was filled with cans, with canned goods and potatoes. I looked at it and kind of laughed. And then I said, well, you know, suppose I called the police or called the fire department or called somebody and said, this shouldn't be here. This is a very unusual thing to be right in the middle of the park with nobody around. What should one do when they see something? That's a different kind of environment. What should one do? Go ahead, Greg.
So you know what your park is. I mean, the whole idea of see something, say something, which it's important to note that the Department of Homeland Security has only adapted that since 2010. New York City had it since 2002. A lot of people think that it's kind of been this federal program. It's only been around for less than 5 years at the federal kind of national scope. But the principle of the concept of the marketing ploy is that you know your neighborhood, right? And you have a sense of what should be there and what shouldn't be there. Now, my guess is that if you were walking the park today and you saw a box and it had wires coming out of it and you moved closer to the box and you heard a ticking sound, you probably would not open it, right? I'm gonna go ahead and assume that you live in a relatively safe area. You feel relatively secure. So you were willing to go in and kind of investigate a little bit further what was in that box. It is the concept is very parochial, and we rely on you to know what it is that's odd about that and make that determination to make that notification. If you called, if you saw wires coming out of the box and you called, we would do the full response. Like, you'd get an officer there and we'd stage fire resources, and we would give the appropriate attention to that sort of call if you deemed it odd enough in your neighborhood.
Remy, they're more sophisticated than that. They're not going to leave something probably with a bunch of wires coming out of it.
Right.
It'd be in a backpack or a suitcase or something. And that's a little bit different than saying something that would immediately arouse suspicion.
Right. And this gets to part of the difficulty of some of these is that it's depending upon individuals who do not have training in threat recognition for the most part. To use their judgment as to what actually constitutes something suspicious or a threat. And I think that's where we see the generation of a lot of false positives you saw this coming out of New York, where I believe it was the two young women who discovered one of the bombs sort of laughed it off at first and as sort of just a precaution on the side did call it in, but their initial response was, this is weird street junk. And... And that sort of is part of the problem is, how do you actually recognize what a threat is? And this can become problematic when people have a particular idea of threat in their mind, which may not actually align with what is a credible threat. And this can lead to things like stereotyping, like profiling, where particular groups are more likely to be singled out as suspicious or potentially threatening when in fact they don't represent a significant threat, and other groups that may be particularly in a particular area or region that you are in may be more likely to generate threat are not seen as threatening.
Greg, who should I call when I see that thing with the wire sticking out of it? Who should I call?
And we know this not only locally, but we know this nationally from some international chiefs of police studies, that it's best to call 911. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we've done a great job breaking down silos over the last 15 years. And there are plenty of ways that if it is something beyond, some trash discarded illegally in your park, it's going to get to the right individuals, whether that's somebody in the DEA, somebody in the ATF, or somebody on the JTTF locally. So that's a fine point of contact, and that officer or that fire captain will be able to make that distinction about where the next channel is.
Remy, isn't there a risk, though, if people become more alert and more suspicious and more concerned that they're going to overwhelm 911 with a lot of calls that turn out to be false?
Well, I think the distinction here isn't more alert, but alert to more specific types of threat, right? It's about a public education of what actually constitutes a threat more than calling in everything that may make you suspicious. And this sort of points to a deeper fundamental problem that we see in social psychology of what's sometimes called the bystander effect, which is sort of the not natural but socially conditioned response that most people have, particularly if there's other people around, to not report on things that may be threatening because they assume that it's somebody else is going to do it. And this is sort of the problem when you particularly have heavily trafficked areas, and people keep asking, why do these suspicious packages in places like New York, which is a huge city full of people day and night, how did they sit out for so long without people noticing it? It's because our natural inclination, particularly when there's others around, is to ignore these things. It's to assume it's somebody else's problem and to not respond to it. And part of that is because we diffuse that responsibility, but part of it's also because we don't have a very concrete idea of what we should be looking for. And if it doesn't fall into that very narrow definition that each of us individually has of threat, we're not likely to react to it in the way that public safety officials might want us to.
Right. What about the neighbor that causes you to be suspicious? Maybe they're repairing a toaster and you think that they're making a bomb and you call 911. I mean, this, and it turns out, number one, that it's a toaster. So, I mean, that to me is an issue that probably is going to pop up more than once. How about that? And what is the liability if you do it?
And I think Greg can speak to the liability issues here, but I think in terms of the overall level, Particularly if that neighbor is somebody that's being identified based off of other sort of stereotyped or incorrect information, it can have effects. And we have seen this a little bit in some of the Muslim communities in places like Southern California and New Jersey, where there is a lot of threats that are called in on the fringes of those neighborhoods where they intersect with other non-Muslim neighborhoods. And it creates a sense of distrust, which can, in fact, in certain instances, inhibit investigations or make it more difficult for them to have trust that when they attempt to access local law enforcement that they will be taken seriously and that those accounts won't be dismissed or overinflated. So that is a potential risk. I'd like to say that we have a good idea of that, but there isn't enough research out there currently to really concretely say how damaging that is.
Greg, your take on it?
Yeah, I think that over the last 14 years, that first New York City and then nationally using the See Something, Say Something campaign, if you actually track the trajectory of this essentially marketing campaign, you will see different markers come up as they have adjusted the theory behind what they want you to call in. And one of those is when it first came out, people were identifying religion or skin color or type of dress as being something suspicious. And New York City has kind of led the way in creating ads that go, no, what we're looking for is the executive briefcase left in a busy train car. That's what we want you. We want you to call on the activity. We want you to call on the action or the particular physical thing that's out of place as opposed to who may be driving behind that. So I think the professor's exactly right. I think there's room there for abuse if people don't completely understand kind of what we're asking them to do. And look, Don, to be clear, I think we have a lot of work in the See Something, Say Something campaign. This has been around more than a decade now, and the majority of the country has never heard of this, according to the latest Gallup poll. I mean, greater than 55% has never even heard about the subject that we're talking about. There's obviously room there for local and federal government to tweak how we present this to the public and better identify the type of things that we want you to call on.
As our time begins to wind down, let me ask you, I'll start with you, Greg, and then to you, Remy. What is your best advice to give people out there who may not know about this campaign, but what's your best advice about being vigilant?
So I think, Don, it's really important to remember what the base of terrorism is and that it's asymmetric and it's very dynamic. It's like water. It finds the lowest point and runs out of whatever crack is down there. So we are constantly, on our side of it, we're constantly adapting and figuring out what the stopgaps are to better prepare our country. Knowing that it's asymmetric in its nature and knowing that it looks for vulnerabilities in the system that you and I kind of exist in every day, the only way that we can go about even having a remote sense of security is if everybody has some collective responsibility. So we would rather you make a report, us come out and investigate or an officer come out and deem it to be a box full of cans than for something to go unnoticed. We certainly don't want to go on unnecessary things, but we have the resources to follow up on good intentions that people identify as being odd in their neighborhood.
Remy, your best advice?
My best advice would be, first of all, to remember that terrorism is a vanishingly rare occurrence. The vast, vast majority of Americans will never experience a terroristic threat in their life in a real way. But beyond that, because it does exist and it is something that people are concerned about, terrorism thrives in ignorance. So if you get to know your neighbors, get to know your community, and that'll help you understand what does and does not belong and also help build these sort of bonds where if there are people who may be feeling marginalized or outsiders that are more drawn to these sorts of things, it helps bring them back in and reinforce sort of a sense of community well-being.
All right. Well, I'll end it right there. I want to thank you gentlemen for being with us. Captain Gregory Favor of the St. Louis Fire Department, thank you for being with us. Dr. Remy Cross with Webster University's Criminal Justice and Sociology Program, thank you so much for being with us. Important advice for our listeners today. We'll be back in a moment with Maria Altman. She is in Ireland. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Still staying behind the headlines now, St. Louis Public Radio has gone international. We have two reporters covering stories overseas, health and science reporter Dori Buscarins in East Africa, and innovation reporter Maria Altman is in Ireland, where some of our local business people are hoping to drum up some business for St. Louis. I spoke to Maria this week and mentioned that the former Maria Hickey, that's her maiden name, must feel right at home on the Emerald Isle.
It does. It does. I've been here twice before, but I do feel a little like I'm coming home every time I'm here. My dad's side of the family is indeed Irish.
Any opportunity to visit ancestral grounds or anything of that kind?
Not this trip. It's been pretty busy, but it's been fantastic just even looking at the scenery, eating the food, and the people here are just so nice. It's wonderful being here.
Where are you exactly?
I am in Tullamore, which is really in what they call the Midlands, County Offaly, which is kind of, it's right between Dublin and Galway, so center of the country.
And it's such a pretty country, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful.
Is it nice and green this time of year?
Absolutely. And today it was raining, so I think it's going to stay that way.
Well, that's not going to keep you from doing your job, of course.
No, not at all. I brought rain gear and boots for the National Plowing Championship.
Okay, well, let's get into exactly what it is you are doing there and what's going on. The Plowing Championship sounds like it's agricultural.
It is. And first, I should say I'm on a delegation from St. Louis that includes BioSTL and the Yield Lab. And the whole idea, I should explain, BioSTL is an organization that is an incubator for startups and a lot of ag tech. And they also have a program to get foreign startups to put a U.S. presence in St. Louis. And so Ireland is one of the markets that they're hoping to do that with. They started in Israel. The Yield Lab is an accelerator that also works with startups, gives $100,000 and mentorship. And they are opening a Galway program. They're hoping to sort of tap into Ireland's innovation and then also get into the European market. So I'm here going to the National Plowing Championships with those two groups. And the Plowing Championships, it is what it sounds like. It's tractors and plowmen literally competing. But there's also a lot of innovation that goes on here. It's the largest ag trade show in Europe.
A couple hundred thousand people or more attended, I understand. That does sound pretty big.
Yeah, about 280,000 last year, and people tell me that it's probably closer to 300,000 and more.
Well, you've talked to a lot of people there about what's going on and trying to get their take on what you're seeing and what they're seeing. Tell us about, I think his name is Mr. Kiernan?
Yeah, Beeman Kiernan. And I got away from what's called the innovation tent for just a few moments to actually see some of the plowing competition. And the supervisor, Beeman Kiernan, came over and was nice enough to explain a little bit about it. And he said it's not about speed. They're not competing, racing each other. It's about the straightness of the rows, and then I'll let him tell the rest.
And ins and outs. Ins and outs. And you can't, no footwork or handwork or pushing or camp. None of that there can be seen, none of the grass. It all has to be turned in. And neatness and pack.
Mr. Kiernan, would you please repeat that? I didn't understand a word.
I can translate because I listened to it several times when I got back to the hotel and was listening to my audio. So he was talking about the ins and outs, so the tractor going in and out of the field, and that they shouldn't put any handprints or footprints in what they've plowed, and that they're also looking for neatness and pack. So apparently there's quite a lot to this.
I guess so, but I'll have to take your word. I'll have to take your word for it. I'm a little unclear, Maria, as to exactly what's going on. You've got the trade show, I gather, on the inside, and this plowing business going on the outside. Is the plowing part of it to show off equipment, that sort of thing?
Well, the plowing is really the heart of the entire event. It started in 1931, and a true story, it was two Irishmen arguing over whose county had better plowmen. So that is what the seed of this whole event. But it has grown into a huge trade show where people tell me most of a lot of agricultural business is done. Huge equipment is sold. And a part of that is also innovation. And I've been in what's called the Innovation Tent, which was sponsored by a government organization called Enterprise Ireland. And the government is really serious about funding startups and promoting innovation. They have the third largest startup fund globally. So they're very serious about spurring innovation and creating products that they can then export.
Do you think they may be where we are with regard to this whole entrepreneurial thing and the world of innovation? We're in pretty good shape here in St. Louis. How are they?
I think that they're looking to us and to St. Louis, you know, somewhat with the plant sciences in particular. Ag tech is a newer area, and in Ireland, agriculture is huge. Food and food products are their biggest export. About 10% of their population is involved in agriculture, but they also have a lot of U.S. tech companies over here. So there's a lot of knowledge in information technology, and those two things are sort of coming together with ag tech, of sort of the marriage of agriculture and technology.
I guess the trend toward American companies going to Ireland is something we really ought to look at, because so many are going because of the tax situation, and that's
right.
That's been criticized here.
It has, but they have it's about a 12% corporate tax rate. They say that is going to remain the same. And I think Ireland is going to become, you know, increasingly important as Brexit, as the UK leaves the European Union, because Ireland will then be the only English speaking country in the European Union. So I don't see that foreign businesses, and especially American businesses, leaving Ireland anytime soon.
Has any business been transacted between our people and the Irish?
You know, I don't get definite answers on that as of yet. I think that there's some, you know, some of the groups are a little bit cautious about who, you know, which startup they're interested in until, you know, maybe they have a deal signed or things are a little bit, you know, further along. But I will say they had a startup pitch competition yesterday between six startups, and there was a lot of interest in some of the companies involved. In fact, one of the Yield Labs managing directors, Brian Clevenger, served as a judge, and the winning company was one called Magro, and it's a really interesting company. They're focused on pesticides and basically creating parts that can be used on existing sprayers that use magnets and create a much more specific spray, and so that there's much less drift. So less pesticide going into the air, less water used, and that's good, they say, for the environment. And I spoke with their CEO, Gary Wickham, and he explains a little bit more about that sustainability point.
So in the U.S., for example, 80% of all water is used in agriculture in California. Wind speeds are high, new regulations coming in all the time, increased buffer zones. It's the same in Europe. There's a thing called the Sustainable Use Directive. So governments are forcing farmers to use less and less and proving why they're using it, and they're losing land. So what we're able to do is bring that land back into play, and we're also allowing farmers to use less to grow more.
Boy, that sounds like something they could use in places like California and out in the West and Southwest.
Absolutely. And their company is saying that they're providing 80% less drift with pesticides. So, you know, it is a pretty dramatic. And I think the next market they're really looking to are row crops in the Midwest. So you can definitely see where St. Louis companies and St. Louis, even venture capital, could be pretty strategic for them.
Maria, do you get the sense that any of the people in our delegation are at all surprised about the kinds of things the Irish are doing? I don't mean this as a negative, but that's not normally the kinds of things you think about when you think about Ireland and what they produce.
I think the scope of it is surprising some, and just also the depths of it with Enterprise Ireland. For example, Magro, the company we were just talking about, their government-funded organization gave Magro $50,000 in a startup round, And they also put them into their incubation center, so they had a place for their offices. And then further down the line, they got 250,000, and I should say euros, not dollars, $250,000 euros, so that they could really grow the company. And they have about 40 employees now. So, you know, they're getting bigger, and Enterprise Ireland is helping them get into foreign markets because they have offices all over the world.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating trip. When are you coming back, or are you coming back?
When you put it that way, I am actually leaving Ireland, and I'll be headed to Israel with BioSTL to meet with some of the companies that they have brought to St. Louis, that have put their U.S. headquarters in St. Louis, and then also going to a couple of agriculture conferences in Israel. So I'm very interested to see what is there, and it's known as the Startup Nation. So I'm sure it's going to be fascinating.
You'll be obviously producing material for us and for our website during the course of this journey, or what do you wait till you come back?
I think I will be producing a story or two from Israel, but I think that the main reporting that I'll be doing will be once I return and can dig into all of it and have a little bit of time to write.
With all of this work that you're doing in the agricultural realm, are you hearing any conversation at all about the proposed deal between Monsanto and Bayer?
You know, what I hear in the startup world is some excitement, in the sense that they look to the pharmaceutical industry and say, you know, when things began to consolidate in that industry, there was a lot of innovation because some people left their jobs and started companies when things got, you know, somewhat unstable. So from the startup perspective, I think that there's a real expectation that this is going to lead to more innovation. But, you know, the people I'm speaking with are from St. Louis, and so there's also a concern about the philanthropic footprint of Monsanto and whether that would continue with Bayer, and also just losing a headquarters is always something that, you know, St. Louisans don't like to see happen.
Yeah, we got a little taste of all of that when InBev acquired Anheuser-Busch, and, you know, a lot of jobs were lost, and people went out into the marketplace and started developing their own craft beers, and it created a whole new industry for this area. So the same thing could happen in ag science.
It could happen. And the one thing I would say, though, is that everyone I speak with say they really do believe Bayer will keep a strong research presence in St. Louis, because they're the most plant science PhDs in the world are in St. Louis. So it only makes sense that that's where they're going to keep it.
Okay, Maria, we'll wrap this up. I know you've got to catch a bus in just a couple of minutes, and have a fun rest of the trip and a safe rest of the trip. And don't spend too much time in that Guinness pub this afternoon.
Thanks very much, Don, but I'm not going to promise that. Do you ever see a copper kettle
mended with an old tin can? That's our Maria Altman, currently on assignment in Europe. We'll be hearing from health and science reporter Duri Bhaskaran from East Africa in a subsequent program.